From 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect Weekend. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Today on the show, we'll hear from a criminal justice reporter who examined the practice of child abuse pediatricians. Then we talk about the rise of political and social activism in sports.
Sports tend to strive to be apolitical, to reach the largest possible audience, and the deal the players struck to go down to Orlando was, well, you're going to have to embrace these viewpoints. You're going to have to let us speak out.
Plus, Milwaukee singer-songwriter Hayward Williams joins us to share his new album made in lockdown, Every Color Blue.
We didn't want to compromise the original vision. We kind of wanted to have this new constraint be something that we could use to kind of steer us creatively and something that we felt like we wanted to try to rise above.
Lake Effect Weekend is next, but first the news. This is Lake Effect Weekend from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. Thanks for tuning in today. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Child abuse is far too prevalent in Wisconsin and across the country, but it's not always easy to spot the maltreatment. Ideally, that's where child abuse pediatricians come in to help. But what happens when they get it wrong? Reporter and novelist Stephanie Clifford wrote about the specialists in an article published by the Marshall Project, a nonprofit news organization covering the U.S. criminal justice system. The investigation focused on two families who were accused of abusing their young children. Both families lost custody of their children based on reports from child abuse pediatricians. Medical evidence later showed other reasons for what had been labeled as abuse. Clifford spoke with Lake Effect's Becca Schimmel about how this specialty came to be and the benefits and pitfalls of it.
I was talking to a lawyer just about general kind of family law stuff, and she kept saying child abuse pediatricians. And finally I was like, I don't know what are you saying? Like child abuse pediatricians? And I started to look into it, and it turned out it's a specialty developed in about the last 10 years. They started certifying child abuse pediatricians. And they're pediatricians who are trained in recognizing child abuse, who know certain patterns of bruising or certain burn patterns that might fit child abuse. And they're installed at most of the major children's hospitals around the country to assess for abuse, because it's a very hard thing to assess for. Most people aren't going to say they're abusing a child. Most little children, at least, aren't going to tell a pediatrician they're abused. So that's the thinking behind having this specialty. Once I heard that there was this term, child abuse pediatricians, I started digging into, well, is this just a term that lawyers are using, or is it a real thing, like a real specialty? So I began looking at it, and I found it was a real specialty. It began getting certified in 2009, and there are hundreds of child abuse pediatricians nationwide now. And they're a pretty tight-knit group. They share a lot of research. They go to conferences together. I started looking at some of those conference topics. I was able to obtain some trainings from child abuse pediatrician training seminars. And what struck me about that is how, obviously, there were medical topics covered, but there were also very specific legal topics covered, like what a Frey hearing is, what a Daubert hearing is. And these are things that, like, you wouldn't learn until the second year of law school, really. But these child abuse pediatricians, because they work so closely with prosecutors or with child welfare workers and child welfare lawyers, and testifying in court is a key part of their job. They're thinking so much from a legalistic perspective from the start.
And so you also spoke with two families who had experiences with these child abuse pediatricians. Can you tell me a little bit about them and their story and how it plays into what you discovered about child abuse pediatricians?
Sure. So the first family is a Wisconsin family. They lived in Racine at the time. He worked at a foundry. She was a bank teller. His name is Jose Santiago. Her name is Glendalise Galarza. And they had a little baby named Elihu, who was a couple months old. It was sort of a normal day. Jose was going to sleep, and he noticed the baby didn't seem to be breathing. And he ran downstairs, splashed water on him. The baby wasn't responding. He was sort of seizing up. He calls 911. They rush the baby to the hospital. He's transferred to Children's in Milwaukee. And there, all of these pediatricians and doctors are surrounding Josue and Glendalise. And they learn later that one of them was a child abuse pediatrician and was not asking questions so that they could treat Elihu as a treating doctor, but so this doctor could find out had somebody abused Elihu, and if so, who was this, and then pass that report on to Children's Protective Services in Wisconsin so they could pursue a case. A similar thing happened with the other family who was outside of Chicago. Their baby had a complicated medical history and had to go back into a hospital, and there they found that there were some unexplained fractures on the baby. And again, they thought they were talking to a treating doctor who was asking them about, you know, family history, what's your marriage like, was this baby planned? And the mom in that case, who's a dentist in suburban Illinois, was just telling this doctor everything, thinking the doctor was treating her baby. And as she said, every word we used ended up in court. Everything was used in a child abuse case against them. And both families ultimately lost their children. And in the Santiago family, the baby died, and Josue was charged with homicide in that death.
Why is it that child abuse pediatricians don't have to identify themselves, or do they?
They don't have to identify themselves as child abuse pediatricians, and often they do not, because it puts the parents on edge and they feel they can't get straight answers, which may be the case, but it also means that these parents are not getting any notice that their words could be used against them, in a family court case, and family court is where child welfare services file to take custody of children from their parents, and B, in a criminal case. So they're not considered state actors, basically. They're not considered like police or prosecutors, so they don't have to give Miranda warnings. In family court, there are very few protections for parents to begin with, so basically parents are just kind of at a huge disadvantage from the start in this situation. And yeah, I totally connect with, like, I have two little kids myself, the idea of like rushing your kid to the ER, which I've done, and having all of these people ask questions, and you try to give them as much information as possible and as many explanations as you can. Like in Josue Santiago's case, they were like, well, maybe it was his little sister who was, you know, playing with him this weekend. Maybe it was this, maybe it was that. And unfortunately, one thing that child abuse pediatricians look out for is a shifting explanation from the parents about the incident. So that may have kind of rung alarm bells in the child abuse pediatrician's mind about, like, maybe these people did hurt their child.
How long have child abuse pediatricians been around, and why was this specialty created?
There was a great doctor I spoke to named Eli Neuberger, who is like this fascinating guy. He lives in Massachusetts. And he sort of tells his career arc, sort of tells the history of child abuse pediatricians. So when he was a young doctor, he got this case. He was asked to review a case of a child who may be being hurt. And he said, sure, like, I'll check in with him over the weekend. And social work said, don't worry about it. Like, you can see him on Monday. By Monday, the child had been killed by his parents. He'd been plunged into scalding bathwater and died what the doctor knew would have been a pretty horrible death. And he was so upset at the idea that he didn't do anything to prevent this. So he went to the chief of his hospital in Boston and asked, what are we doing about child abuse? What are we doing about cases that we're referring to child welfare? And the head of the hospital said, we're really not doing anything. What should we be doing? And so he started to look around, and he learned that there were only a couple of hospitals at that point reviewing child welfare cases formally and making discharge plans. And so he modeled what the hospital in Boston was doing after that. It was a group of social workers, child welfare workers, pediatricians, all thinking about, okay, what's a safe plan for this child so that they can hopefully go home with the parents, but also so that the parents can get the help they need. So over the years, he became something of an expert on child abuse. A few other pediatricians became similar experts on child abuse. And by the late 90s, they were thinking about, well, should this become a specialty? Should this become something that we have an examination for? And Dr. Neuberger thought, no. He was concerned that it would make the child abuse pediatricians more sort of an arm of the law or an arm of prosecutions rather than more independent investigators into whether abuse had occurred. But he was outvoted, it became a specialty anyway. And by 2009, they were issuing exams and certifying pediatricians as these child abuse pediatricians.
Is there any review of what child abuse pediatricians say or any kind of check on their specialty, their power, and things like that?
That's a great question. And I think that's one of the things that this investigation for the Marshall Project and the Atlantic gets into, is that there's not really a check on them. In part, the other doctors at the hospital don't want to make a call about child abuse, and it's tricky. The families are upset, obviously, and they don't want to spend their time testifying. They want to spend their time in the hospital treating patients. So they're generally more than happy to hand over the call on whether this or isn't abuse to a child abuse pediatrician. The problem from there is that the child abuse pediatrician has unchecked power. They can, and we saw in this case, the child abuse pediatrician was overruling other specialists. They were, in these cases, I should say, were overruling other specialists, were kind of doing some follow-up tests, but perhaps not all, were discounting things that other specialists suggested, were discounting certainly the family's explanations. And then once the child abuse pediatrician, who's this, you know, erudite doctor, hands the diagnosis of, yes, this is likely abuse, over to a child welfare worker, who you have to imagine is usually pretty young, has a 2 or 4 year college degree, but doesn't really have the authority to stand up to an eminent pediatrician, the child welfare worker isn't going to go against that either, even if she or he thinks, well, maybe, you know, maybe there's not abuse here. That's, you're safer as a child welfare worker saying, yes, there's abuse, let me separate the family, than you are saying, well, maybe let me challenge what this doctor says.
And in talking with child abuse pediatricians through your reporting, what did you learn and what raised even more questions for you?
I think they believe that they're just one part in this process. And technically, yes, they are, but in reality, they have so much more power than anybody else in the process that child welfare, police, prosecutors, all, I just found, were just repeating their words verbatim, even when there was virtually no way that any of those players really understood what they were saying. It was these incredibly technical, fine, you know, scattered foci of hyperattenuation. I don't even know if I'm pronouncing that correctly, but that was like repeated over and over in a report in the Santiago case. And you would see it repeated by police, repeated by prosecutors, repeated by even, you know, the medical examiner. So basically whatever the child abuse pediatrician says goes. And there was this upsetting, I would say, police question and answer with Josue Santiago. This is, his baby's in the hospital. He knows at that point his baby is brain dead and has maybe a day or two left to live. And the police brought him and the baby's mom in for questioning at a police station separately. And they questioned each of them for 6 hours. And the police kept saying, Dr. Rabbit, who's the child abuse pediatrician at Children's Milwaukee, who declined to comment for the story, but they kept saying, Dr. Rabbit says this can happen one of two ways. Either it's like a really hard car crash or you hurt the baby. And they just kept saying, like, she says you hurt the baby. She says, and he says, no, 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 I didn't. And in their minds, her report by then had become hard fact and was sort of incontrovertible. And you see this moment in the transcript of the Q&A where they leave, the investigator leaves the room, and Josue, whose first language is Spanish, he's from Puerto Rico, is praying in Spanish, and he's just like, oh my God, like, we didn't do this. Please, Father, please, like, we didn't do this. And it, you know, when I talked to him later, and he was saying, he was like, my baby is dying in the hospital, and I'm having to have this 6 hour interrogation over, like, did I do it? Just say you did it. It was just heartbreaking.
What are the benefits of this specialty and what are the drawbacks?
The benefits are that you have somebody on staff who specializes in this. So that if a child comes in with a strange bruise, a regular pediatrician won't say like, oh yeah, it's just a bruise. Yeah, it does sound like she fell off the swing, when it's clear to a specialist that there's no way you could get a bruise like that from falling off a swing or another accident, that it would have to be somebody was hurting the child intentionally. And there are so many cases of child abuse in the US. It's a terrifying thing. And so many of them are, so many of the victims can't speak or won't speak. You know, they're under 3 or under 4 and either won't explain what happened to them or are not verbal at that point. So they catch a lot of cases that otherwise might not be caught. The danger is that, you know, they are trained to find child abuse, and therefore I think at least in these cases and in some of the other cases I reviewed, they find child abuse where there are other explanations. And it happens more frequently, and some of the research I looked into shows that child abuse pediatricians overdiagnose abuse, particularly in low-income families, in non-white families, and that is problematic because those people, of course, often have the fewest protections in court and may not be able to afford lawyers to fight out the case or to get their children back.
So in your reporting, did you find or talk to anybody who had solutions to this overreporting of child abuse while also needing specialists who can identify abuse?
Yeah, I think there are a couple of solutions at play. So one is in play in Texas. Congress there, the state Congress, is considering requiring a second opinion on all child abuse diagnoses. And I think that would perhaps have the child abuse pediatricians proceed with more care. Another idea that a few of the older pediatricians that I spoke to floated was having much more rigorous review of, okay, so you said it was abuse. Is there any substantiation of that? Like if the child was returned to the family, as the child in the Illinois case was ultimately returned to the family, did further abuse occur? Did the child have a healthy childhood? So looking back and doing outcome studies on what happened, I think would be incredibly useful. But right now, it's one of the rare fields in medicine where there's not much review. There's not much analysis of where did we get it right? Where did we get it wrong? Where, you know, if you're doing a heart operation and something goes wrong, you're immediately delving into every bit of, well, what happened here and what factors can we change? Where in child abuse pediatrics, it's not, that's not really followed up on.
Stephanie Clifford is a novelist and reporter covering criminal justice and business. Her work has appeared in The New Yorker, Wired, Marie Claire, and other publications. She spoke with Lake Effect's Becca Schimmel. Coming up next, we explore the rise of political and social activism in sports. Lake Effect Weekend continues on Milwaukee's NPR. Lake Effect Weekend continues on WUWM. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. The Milwaukee Bucks shocked some fans on August 26 when they chose not to take to the court for their scheduled playoff game in protest of the shooting of Jacob Blake. Blake was left paralyzed after being shot in the back multiple times by Kenosha police officer Rustin Chesky. The decision by the Bucks was supported by the NBA, which decided to cancel all 3 scheduled playoff games for that Wednesday. The Milwaukee Brewers followed suit, deciding to skip their game, and other Major League Baseball teams joined in on the boycott. In some ways, the decision was historic and unprecedented. But it can also be seen as the culmination of a season in sports that has been noticeably and unmistakably political. From Black Lives Matter painted on NBA courts, to jerseys that replace names with things like, "I can't breathe," and "enough." UW-Milwaukee Assistant Professor Michael Myrer says there hasn't been a time in sports history as profoundly political as what we're seeing today. He joins Lake Effect's Joy Powers to talk about sports and activism.
So this might be a kind of vague question to begin with, but I think it kind of sets up the tone of the rest of our conversation. When we think about sports in the U.S., what do you think sports teams really mean to American culture?
You know, I think One of the things that we see just time after time is that sports teams are one of these ways that cities just come to define themselves. And we can go back to sort of the rise of cities. So after the Civil War, Americans start piling into cities. And one of the ways that these local newspapers and these local boosters started to define themselves is through the use of sports teams, the use of the creation of civic pride in sports teams. And so sports teams in the United States have really been these notions of civic pride. I think one of the interesting things about us here, as opposed to, say, Europe, is that our sports system has tended to operate in a local monopoly system. So there really is only one basketball team in a city, right? There's some accidents like Chicago and New York and other places where there are multiples. But really, you know, there's only been one major team per sport in most cities. And so rather than sports being the teams representing different neighborhoods or different aspects, like if you follow English soccer, right, there's different neighborhoods, different parts of London that various teams represent. In the United States, they really have been this sort of citywide institution. And as such, you know, the challenge in sort of maintaining that position for many, many years has really been to try to, you know, sit above politics. And I know that's where we're going. So that's been part of it, is that the idea of keeping politics out of sports has been a really important article of faith for a long time. Because, you know, if you think about, you know, the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, right? Democrats and Republicans both read the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, but everybody is assumed to be a Bucks fan. So as long as you keep the politics away, the Bucks, the Brewers, the Packers, you know, it becomes this kind of thing that belongs to everybody.
With that in mind, in some ways, activism has been a part of sports in the United States as long as we've had sports teams. But there's always been complicated views about what that activism should look like and whether or not it's appropriate. When we look back historically, what do we view now as being some of the highlights of sports activism?
Well, I think the highlights of sports activism, you know, I think one of the things that's been interesting in the last couple of days is people talking about these hidden moments of sports activism that I had, you know, that I had never heard of, right? But we do have these major moments, right? You have Muhammad Ali in the 60s. You have John Carlos and Tommy Smith raising their fists at the 1968 Olympics. Right. These are these sort of great moments of sort of oppositional activism that really become iconic moments in our culture. Right. People hold up that image of the sprinters on the award pedestal holding up their fists is something that we all are familiar with and we all recognize. I think that, you know, at the time being, though, those were not widely accepted positions. Right. Those guys were deeply unpopular for making those choices. Muhammad Ali was widely hated for not going to the draft, for not going to Vietnam. So, you know, those, I think, are the major moments we think about. I guess I'll say there's been a lot of activism in the 60s around issues of segregation, players, basketball teams and college football teams trying to play in the South when the whole team couldn't stay at the same hotels, right? And so that's come up a lot. And then we also have moments of labor activism, which has really been a part of American sports since the mid-60s, where players have started to form unions and push those issues forward, employment issues forward, and bring those to the public, which, of course, is a form of class politics. But what we have in this case is that it's always really unpopular at the time, right? That we look back on it, Muhammad Ali's a beloved figure now, in part because I think most people agree that he was right. Vietnam wasn't a great idea. But at the time, nobody agreed with that, right? At the time, nobody thought it was right that the calls for equal rights for African Americans was a proper position, especially not one to bring into sports.
You know, as you mentioned, some people believe it's inappropriate for sports stars to use their platform to advance social justice causes. And it's a rationale that I personally don't quite understand. Can you unpack that line of thought and where this idea comes from that by virtue of being a professional athlete, you should leave your politics aside?
So I think it goes back to what we started with, is that the idea in the United States is really that sports are a place of unity, right? That athletics are a place that we come together and, you know, doesn't matter what color you are, we all wear the same team logo on our chest, right? And it doesn't matter what race the athletes are, you know, we all root for our home team. And so when athletes choose to speak out, for a long time, I think the view was, well, you're bringing politics into this space that's supposed to be apolitical. Now, there's a bit of ridiculousness to that viewpoint, right? I mean, think about where the teams are playing, right? Professional sports teams play in publicly funded arenas, and the players are, in many cases, trained at public universities to play these various sports, right? Most of the major athletic factory college teams are public universities. And the players come from a variety of backgrounds, and their experiences are shaped in certain ways. And so when athletes step up to say, hey, my experience says this is something is wrong or this is a problem, I think they often are faced with people who say, well, sure, but this is not really the place for it, right? Sports is really where we come to relax, where we come to pull together. And bringing politics into that, making political statements within that, has been seen as sort of creating matter out of place, creating the idea that we're imposing a certain logic into sports that doesn't belong there. Now, of course, you know, I'm a college professor, right? So of course I would say that being apolitical is in fact a political viewpoint, but that's not, you know, that the idea of that view has not really gained broader purchase, at least not until recently.
So, you know, I feel like we've seen kind of evolving attitudes on the place of activism inside of sports. And this year, we've seen a lot of activism among many leagues, but we're seeing it right now with both basketball and Major League Baseball. Can you talk a bit about what we've seen this year just overall?
I mean, sure, it's been a really incredible couple of months here to watch basketball players. And I think part of it is that normally in the middle of May and June, they would be deep in the playoffs and focusing on who's going to make the finals, who's going to win the championship. We were all off, right? Everything was shut down. Sports was shut down, a rarity in our society to have sports disappear. And so, you know, I think everybody saw the George Floyd video, or at least saw stills, or at least knew what happened. And what's been impressive is just been how willing NBA players have been to put themselves into this protest movement. We're a long way away from the period of time where, you know, the Michael Jordan, you know, Republicans buy sneakers too, which is not to say that Republicans thought what happened to George Floyd was okay. Many of them didn't. But what we see, you know, what we saw is that athletes sought to be apolitical for a long time. And, you know, and it's not like we haven't seen athletes struggle, get in trouble for being political before. But here, in the case of what the NBA players did, is they put themselves on the front lines. They were leading protest movements. They were leading march. You know, the Milwaukee Bucks players were part of a protest march. They stood up and they said, this is wrong and this affects us directly. And what's been interesting is that when the NBA approached them about restarting the season, going down to Orlando, doing it in the bubble, as we say, this was the ability to sort of bring those ideas to the forefront, to speak openly about social justice, to put Black Lives Matter on the court, to let people put slogans on their jerseys. That was part of the rationale for the players, right? This situation that they're in, right? They're away from their families. They're locked up in a, you know, in a luxurious area, but it's still they're limited what they can do and who they can see. And so, you know, the idea that they could sort of use this platform was, I think, something that was appealing to them and something we really hadn't seen before. Again, sports tend to strive to be apolitical, to reach the largest possible audience. And the deal the players struck to go down to Orlando was, well, you're going to have to embrace these viewpoints. You're going to have to let us speak out. And so that's how it started. That's what the players did. And that was really, really impressive and really unusual in the grand scheme of how sports tend to work.
It does seem like such a peculiar year. I mean, for so many reasons, as I'm sure everyone would agree. We've seen a lot of different ways that the NBA in particular, but also other leagues, have, you know, put these messages out there. You mentioned, of course, things on the court, things on their jerseys that say, you know, Black Lives Matter, that speak to this fight for racial equity and justice. It did feel like, though, the move to cancel games was a new step, was a bigger step in some ways. What do you think the impact of actually just canceling these games, what do you think the impact of that was?
So I think when we think about sort of social movements and the push to sort of put ideas on the public agenda, you know, athletes, when they do speak out, are really effective at that because their workplaces are full of cameras, right? So most protest groups really struggle to get media attention and athletes don't. And so when they went down there, part of it was getting media attention for their cause. But I think they rightly, you know, deduced that in some ways that it all faded into the woodwork, right? That, you know, after 3.5 weeks of watching games on courts that say Black Lives Matter, people stopped noticing, right? That the idea of there being a problem with policing in this country becomes sort of no longer is top of mind, right? It sort of fades into the woodwork. And so after the shooting of Jacob Blake, and especially for the Milwaukee Bucks, who, you know, Kenosha is not that far from where they play, I think this next action, some call it a boycott, it's actually more of a strike, although they might not want to use that term because they're actually not allowed to strike based on their collective bargaining agreement. Part of what happens is that it propels this back into public view again, right? It forces people to connect back to that original message, right? That there are problems that need to be addressed and that the problems are not being addressed. So the move to cancel games and in the way they did it too, which is basically not telling anybody and deciding to do it just at the last moment, right before tip off, they didn't come out for warmups before the game. That, again, was a way of attracting attention to the reason that they were there in the first place. And so that move is something that's really, it's a really good way to try to bring attention back to your original message. And so that's what I think was really unusual and interesting about what happened on Wednesday.
Yeah. Now, there are some on the right, specifically conservatives, who are saying they'll never watch basketball again. They have said similar things about football when we saw more political activism among football players. How do these kinds of counter movements impact the world of sports? And do we see this having a lasting and possibly negative impact?
You know, I think there probably are people who will walk away. You know, I think ultimately, if you're a person who views their party affiliation as stronger than their team affiliation, then you're probably not a person who was already a major customer for those teams, right? So in that regard, potentially, that's maybe not a huge deal. The idea of sports becoming sort of politics by other means, I think, does raise a lot of very interesting questions about the implications for sports, right? We have Fiserv Forum, right? This beautiful arena that's downtown that was supposed to host the Democratic Convention and that, you know, took a lot of public money. If sports are more partisan, become more of a partisan political object, are they still going to be able to command public money? You know, if something like the Super Bowl stops being the mass audience event, that changes the entire sports landscape and media system, right? So we do have these questions, right? As politics get imposed onto sports, as people start to sort of articulate these connections, I think we do see some very interesting implications. I think ultimately, you know, the people who are willing to walk away from this, over this, you know, the basketball players have been doing this for 3 months, right? If this was the last straw, you know, they probably weren't paying that close of attention to begin with.
Yeah. Well, Michael Myrer, thank you so much for joining us here on Lake Effect and sharing your work.
Great. My pleasure.
Michael Myrer is a visiting assistant professor at UW-Milwaukee in the Department of Journalism, Advertising, and Media Studies. He spoke with Lake Effect's Joy Powers. Coming up next, our Pandemic Performers series features Milwaukee's own Hayward Williams. Lake Effect Weekend continues on WUWM. Lake Effect Weekend continues on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Among the group of artists we've had in the Lake Effect Performance Studio, singer-songwriter Hayward Williams has been a consistent local performer. However, this time we feature Williams in our Pandemic Performers series, where we highlight some of the work coming from Milwaukee artists and performers at a time when many of us are still isolated. Williams' latest album, Every Color Blue, was slated to be recorded live in the spring of 2020. As the coronavirus pandemic surfaced and continues, Williams and the musicians on the album had to adjust course. He joins me now and explains how this record came together.
Well, initially, I wanted to begin recording something and try to get as much work as I on it that I could get done as I could before my son was born in April. That was the original plan. And then once the world started shutting down, then the plan became, well, let's work on something because that sounds like something productive and positive to do with my already like anxiety ridden mind. So it became just a good thing to work on. And so we just did our best to just kind of plug away at it.
And with the songwriting, there's 12 tracks on this album. Were the songs already written before you decided to continue and carrying on putting the record together? Or were these songs also written during quarantine time?
No, it was all the pre-production and everything was ready to go. So luckily, everything was poised to be worked on and ready to go. And so then at that point, it was all just a matter of us trying to troubleshoot how we were going to combine everything and make it work and make it work well. Some songs were written after the 2016 election, and some of them were written in January of this month. So it's kind of this wide swath of time. But once you have this kind of new prism that you're putting everything through of everybody being quarantined and everybody just kind of doing their best and trying to make it work, then that becomes the unifying factor of everything, regardless of when the songs were written.
This album also has a rich, full feeling. So you mentioned pre-production was pretty set to go, but how did you end up pulling all the different elements together of other musicians featured, the other singers, everything? You know, blues and soulful music, I think, has a tendency to be really strong, even if you just have the basics of keys, drums, guitar, and vocals. But there's a lot more to it, especially with some of these tracks, to get a bigger richness.
Right. Well, the original theme and kind of bullseye we were going for was like a classic kind of soul record. So most of your classic soul records have full orchestration and instrumentation, and so that was the jumping off point. And then once we began our kind of new production schedule, it was whoever could help out, whoever was available, whoever had the right kind of gear to make it work. But we didn't want to compromise the original vision. We kind of wanted to have this new constraint be something that we could use to kind of steer us creatively, and something that we felt like we wanted to try to rise above.
Well, I think you accomplished that because you add guest vocalists, string quartet, and Sturgill Simpson's horn section to just elevate many of these tracks.
Well, yeah. Well, I think this is the fourth record that I've made with this cast of musicians. And so I'm very lucky to be able to work with the musicians that I know and call friends and colleagues now. And not only are my connections coming into play with who we're getting to play on the record and when, but also we're using all their connections. And so just with having people spread all over the country, then you have kind of a large pool to draw from. And so I think everyone that we contacted was also looking for something to do in some way to stay relevant and viable and not just sitting around, you know, like eating cookies by the sleeve, you know.
I think that's an activity we've all partaken in at least once during this time.
Yeah. Multiple times, yeah.
So to throw it back a bit, you had an interview with us back in 2014, and you commented on how the album The Reef, that the energy of that album is a result of recording your band playing live in a room together. You know, you mentioned that it's the only way you can feel that you can get excited about the record. So how did you find yourself finding that same energy for this record, or did you embrace the different feelings behind making music in lockdown and all the challenges and sounds that come with it?
The easy way to embrace it is the fact that I had to. And the original plan was to do this record live in the room and kind of have that energy in the air of the room be changed by what we were doing. But I think just having the specter of everything kind of hanging over what I was doing, it forced me and kind of impelled me to put that same amount of energy that I might have been feeling in a room, and it compelled me to do it myself, because I didn't know when the next time I was going to be able to make a record. So I said, regardless of the fact that it's not the way you want it to be, you better make it count. And so that was kind of the posture that I was taking into it.
So obviously you had this goal, this drive. What other roles did music take on for you during this time?
Well, it's this session and this record was very therapeutic. And not that it hasn't been before, but I think it's been purely therapeutic this time around. Whereas before I felt, you know, well, you know, it's been X amount of years or X amount of time. It's time to make a record. Who are you going to get to do it? Where are you going to do it? And kind of starting to map things out. Whereas this time it was like, I'm going to go downstairs and try to get something done. You know, I'm going to go into my basement. I'm going to give myself 45 minutes. Maybe that's all the time I have. And whatever I get done is what I get done. And it's kind of a beautiful carrot on the end of the stick to kind of help you get through a day where it felt exactly the same as the day before.
One of these tracks is called Fade Away, and this song starts with the lyrics, "Felt arrested by that old feeling." And I think those moments come maybe a bit more often during this time. Can you tell us a little bit more about this song?
Well, this song in particular, it took on new meaning. Originally, the song is just a very sentimental song about someone who had to leave their car downtown after a night of drinking and walk home through their old neighborhood and just think about the past and think about old flames and bad decisions and things like that. And so it's a very simple song in that respect, and kind of how no matter what you do, those memories and those experiences kind of all just disappear at some point. But as we were recording it, and as it was becoming bigger and bigger with strings and with everything, and it kind of felt more like the things that were fading away were everyday freedoms, real freedom, even family members that are fading away or already gone. And so it was less of a sentimental kind of sappy ballad and more of like a singing your heart out while the candle is starting to flicker away kind of thing.
Felt arrested by that old feeling, so I swore that I'd never take your street again. After midnight, my head
past, you've dealt with a lot of anxiety when it comes to touring and performing in front of audiences, but now that that's, I mean, not completely out of the equation, but has changed so fundamentally, has your relationship with that aspect of being a musician changed, or, you know, has putting your effort towards this album been a better therapy for you? I'm just curious what you think about having that aspect of your life just kind of being put on hold for a little bit.
Well, it's definitely, it brings a lot of uncertainty, you know, easily as everyone is experiencing. But my family has grown a lot in the past few years. And on one hand, that has served to kind of curb a lot of my anxiety, because it's such a focusing thing to have children and to have that kind of new part of your life becomes so strong and so important to you. So I've started touring and playing less already and didn't have the time or the anxiety to really feel one way or another about it. And not to say that I'm glad that quarantine happened, but it is, you know, kind of further driven the nail in for me that I already don't play as much as I used to. So not having the opportunity now doesn't feel like more of a severing of a limb or anything like that. It just feels like, well, there you go. You know, it is what it is.
Well, and do you find your three kids to be receptive audiences for when you're working out things for the album?
They are receptive if I'm like playing it through the speakers, like if I'm listening to a track or anything like that. But if I'm like trying to like play guitar or anything like that, it just infuriates them and they ask me to stop. They're just like, "Daddy, don't do that. Don't play. Don't sing." So that's why my window to work is always at night in the basement when everybody's in bed.
Away from the tough crowd.
Such a tough crowd. No filter. Yeah.
Another pretty great thing about this album, it has 8 original songs, but also 4 written by friends. And I'm hoping you can tell me a bit more about the duet, Put Down the Fight. That track really stood out to me.
Oh, great. Yeah, I wanted to make a record, and I originally, a long time ago, wanted to make a record with only songs that were written by friends of mine. And then as I was doing that, I was finding it harder and harder to kind of find my own voice within them. So I took the ones that were working for me and kind of implanted them into this more recent batch of songs that I had, and decided that I would just do it that way. And I did that primarily because, one, it seemed like kind of an easy way to fill out a record, and two, it's always really exciting when a peer plays your song or plays it live or does anything with it. And so I wanted to pay that forward and pass that along and play other people's songs, and hopefully they get as much of a thrill out of it as I do. And that song was a song I had written a long time ago and wanted it to be a part of a record I did with my good friend and collaborator John Harden for a record that we put out called Coyote Brother, which is a very like cowboy kind of ballad duet, sad murder ballad country record. And I wrote this song and I really wanted to show it to John and have him be like, that's great, let's put it on the record. And that really wasn't the way it went down. And that, I don't think that was because it was a good song or a bad song. I think maybe it just didn't fit what we were going for at the time. And so I still wanted to do it. And I love John's voice. And so I just kind of made him sing it. And so like, I kind of got what I wanted anyway, even though it wasn't on the Coyote Brother record. So it's kind of like a backdoor song. And kind of a way to force my friend to sing the song I always wanted him to sing.
Well, I think it's a great song, and I think it fits in well with the album overall. And having this collaboration and so many musicians involved, giving it such a full sound, you know, you write that it's giving audiences something that's missing right now, soul. How do you hope people come away after listening to the album?
I love soul music. I love everything about it. I love Al Green. I love Marvin Gaye. I love Dusty Springfield. I love Aretha Franklin. Like, it's, they're so ingrained, I think, in pop music as well as just soul music. And regardless of whether it makes you sad or happy or dance, like, I feel like it's such an American genre and such an important genre. And I always find a way to make it applicable into my everyday kind of living and life and thought mentality. And especially with the political upheaval and everything that's going on, like, soul music is such a important tool and a way to bring people together. And I was hoping that since we can't actually be together, that at least we could listen to some good music and hopefully feel and maybe at least remember what that was like to be together.
Well, I thank you for your efforts in making this album available. I certainly enjoyed listening to it. And next time, we'll have you in the studio for your next album in a few years. Hopefully things will be good by then. But I really appreciate your time and speaking with me today.
A pleasure to speak to an adult. Very exciting to me. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Hayward. Hayward Williams is a Milwaukee-based singer-songwriter, and his latest album, out now, is called Every Color Blue. We spoke with him as a part of our Pandemic Performer series. And that wraps up the show for today. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Thanks for making us a part of your afternoon. Lake Effect Weekend airs every Saturday and Sunday from 3 to 4, right here on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. Stay tuned now for All Things Considered coming up next. It's 4 o'clock.
You hold a part of my soul, makes me